care physician, deputy director, center.
I'm Glenn Long, principal of World Care Center.
Hi, Don Sisti. I manage a project on mental health ethics.
I'm John Mers.
Hi, Jen Lee Singh, director of fiscal operations.
I'm Autumn Feaster. I'm the director of graduate studies, and I work mostly in clinical ethics and LGBT bioethics.
Right.
Okay, perfect. Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to come to Philadelphia and talk to you about some of my work. So what I'm going to do in the roughly 20 minutes is I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background and the kind of work that I've done in the past, really the bulk of the time I want to spend on talking to you about some of the projects I hope to be doing over the next few years. So my background is in political philosophy. I did my PhD in political philosophy, and I was working in particular on a theory called lack of libertarianism. So that's a theory of distributive justice. So it's a theory that's meant to tell us when a particular distribution is fair or unfair, when our inequality is fair or unfair. So the basic starting point for lack of egalitarians is the idea that inequalities are fair if and only if they are the results of choices that people can, that people should be held responsible for. So there's this idea that where inequalities are due to luck or circumstances that an individual couldn't control, then those inequalities would be unfair. But there might be inequalities that are the result of the right sorts of choices that individuals make. And when that's the case, those inequalities on the lack of egalitarian approach would be fair and they wouldn't be problematic. So the focus of my dissertation was to sort of on the theoretical side was to really spell out how you really draw this distinction, because obviously the choices that we make are influenced by all sorts of factors that were beyond our control, so there isn't an obvious way of really drawing this distinction, but it's obviously a crucial distinction for the approach, because you know you need to know how you're going to flesh this idea out if you're going to be able to say anything about actual inequalities. So that was the sort of theoretical side of my dissertation, but I was also very interested in how this theory might be applied to the real world. So in my dissertation, I look primarily at higher education in the UK context, where you know there's a very hierarchical university system, and where you go really matters. But there's also, we know empirically, that what happens is that a lot of working class students and ethnic minority students, they just will not apply to the prestigious universities even when they're qualified. So this, I think, is an interesting question from, you know, for a theory of distributive justice to tell us something about this kind of context, especially for the theory that places a lot of emphasis on some notion of choice. But we also have a lot of empirical evidence that tells us something about the sometimes very subtle mechanisms in which those choices are influenced by background factors and so on. So I think this was a very interesting area to be working on. So I was beginning to get interested in how this kind of work might be applied to the health context, and I got an opportunity to kind of really start working on this when I moved to Harvard as a postdoc in the program in ethics and health. And to my mind, it was really, you know, as a postdoc, that was really a fantastic place to be, because the faculty spent a lot of time giving us a good grounding in what's happening in medical ethics and what's happening in public health ethics, and we also had a lot of time to develop our own projects. So during that time, I became very interested in issues around smoking and tobacco control, and I also did some work on the use of incentives to encourage healthier behaviours. And then in the subsequent year, I moved back to the UK, to Lancaster, where I worked on a project on childhood obesity and some of the ethical considerations around strategies to prevent or address childhood obesity. So really what I try and do when I'm looking at these applied issues is to kind of approach them with the kind of theoretical questions in mind that I have been working on. So things like questions around choice and responsibility, or equality in terms of how the benefits and burdens of a particular policy might be distributed, or what does it mean for people to have equal access to a particular benefit. So these are the kinds of questions that, given my background, I find, you know, that come quite natural. And I guess in terms of my general approach, I do the sort of, I do a lot of, you know, I do theoretical work, but I also do a lot of applied work, and I often talk about these sort of separate aspects of my work, but really, to me, what's become quite apparent is that it's actually very helpful to have both of these aspects to my work. Because obviously, when you're, you know, when you're doing applied work, it's very good to have thought about some of the theoretical issues, perhaps in a very abstract way. But also, it's often when you look at applied questions or the questions in the real world that you begin to see the kind of limitations of a particular theory, or that you begin to see sort of interesting theoretical questions that you can then think about again in more abstract terms. It's something that I find very helpful to have both of these aspects to my work, and it's given me an opportunity to work a bit, you know, to look into other disciplines as well and do some interdisciplinary work. So for the kind of work I want to be doing in the future, I kind of see this along three different strands. So the first of these strands is to continue with the kind of analysis of different policy issues that I've been doing over the past couple of years, really. So one issue that interests me, we just talked about this, is the idea of health measurement and how health measures can be used in decisions about resource allocation. So I think philosophers often find health measures very interesting because there are all sorts of philosophical issues in how you actually get to a health measure. But I suppose for someone like me, what's really interesting is what do you do with those health measures when you have them? How can you use them in decisions that you make about priority setting or resources or rationing? So in the UK, for example, health measures are used in decisions about whether or not to recommend particular treatments for funding. And I'm also very interested in the Global Burden of Disease Project, which tries to sort of capture the state of global health and to give us some sense of what kinds of health conditions are contributing to the global burden of disease. But they also, you know, the researchers who do this, they also think that this is something that could be very helpful in decisions about where we're going to put funds in global health. So both at a kind of very macro level where you're, you know, you might be thinking about should we be putting money into infectious disease or into the prevention of chronic disease, or, you know, but also at a very micro level where you might be saying, well, I have $1 million, should I spend it on bed nets to prevent the spread of malaria, or should I be spending it on education to prevent the spread of HIV? So, you know, it's a measure that's meant to be very helpful in these kinds of decisions. So what seems to be happening in the kind of in the reaction to these health measures is that you have a somewhat polarized debate. So on the one hand, you have people who are completely opposed to using these measures in any kind of way, and on the other hand, you have what seems like sometimes a somewhat simplistic use of these health measures, where it's just a matter of, well, how many DALIs can you prevent with a certain amount of money, which isn't really, I think, how you should be using these measures. So I think there is scope for really carving out some arguments about what you can do with these measures and what you can't do with them, and what role, you know, how you can helpfully use them in a way that helps you make decisions about resource allocation, and, you know, but also be clear about the limits of those measures. Another area that interests me is, as I said, I've done some work on the use of incentives, but most of that has been in wealthy countries like the US or Germany. But of course, incentives are also used in the developing world, primarily in the form of conditional cash transfers. So that's something I find quite interesting, because it seems that this might raise a completely different set of ethical concerns, because you're dealing with a much poorer population. So the question of whether you're making aid conditional on certain requirements, I think, takes on a slightly different, becomes very potentially more problematic. But also there is this argument that in those contexts, conditionality actually plays a very different role. So there is an argument that conditionality isn't really meant to change behaviour primarily, but it's actually meant to help you identify the poor. So if you pick the right kinds of conditions for the aid that you're providing, you're ensuring that only actually really poor people are going to try and get the money. So it's, you know, in a resource poor country, that's a good alternative to having some sort of expensive way of means testing. So I think that's quite interesting. So those would be sort of a couple of examples of that I think follow quite naturally from the work I've already been doing. But these might be, I think, somewhat shorter projects. So what I also hope to do is to develop two broader projects that raise both philosophical issues, but also have implications for real policy issues or questions in the real world, and that also tie together some of the considerations and concerns that have come out of my previous work. And the first of these projects is to look at health inequalities and how you actually measure them. So of course, health inequalities in a lot of countries and also globally is something policymakers have become very concerned about, and some countries at least are putting a lot of money into attempts to reduce health inequalities. So we kind of want to make sure that we know what it is we're trying to reduce. So really, what made me think that there might be conceptual issues in thinking about health inequalities was the debate that came after the 2000 World Health Report. We just talked about this. So the 2000 World Health Report was the World Health Report that ranked the healthcare systems in the world according to how good they were. So that was going to be controversial. But another controversial thing they were doing was one of the criteria that they used to rank these healthcare systems was to have some measure of health equality within individual countries. And what they did was they measured health equality as differences in health outcomes across individuals, whereas pretty much all of the empirical literature thinks of health inequality as differences in health outcomes across social groups, like socioeconomic status groups or ethnic groups. So that caused a bit of a stir, and there was some vague attempt to defend the individual approach, but then that debate kind of died. So I think that was a pity, because there are a lot of kind of interesting philosophical questions that you can raise that come out of this debate, but also there might be practical implications that I think are worth considering. So from the philosophical side, the more I thought about it, the more I realised that actually, given the theory I've been working with, like egalitarianism, actually the WHO approach of measuring individual health inequalities actually makes a lot more sense, because if you're looking at social groups, you're always kind of averaging out, and you're missing out on inequalities within those groups. So it gives you, so it seems to underestimate the actual full extent of unfair health inequality that there might be. So that, I think, is a concern. And if you look at the health inequality literature, there are a number of assumptions that philosophers also often make about what kinds of inequalities cannot be unfair. So there is this assumption that inequalities that have natural causes, those couldn't be unfair. And there's also this assumption that if inequality cannot be remedied, and if there was nothing that could have been done to avoid it, then also it can't be unfair. So this is really what seems to drive this concern with social groups and inequalities across social groups rather than inequalities across individuals. And like egalitarians actually reject these assumptions, and it seems that neither in the sort of health inequalities debate or in the more philosophical debate there has been any real attempt to either defend those assumptions or to really defend those aspects of the like egalitarian approach. So I think there is a lot of there's a lot of room for some interesting philosophical work that either kind of that really makes a case for these either for these assumptions or against them. But also in terms of the empirical work, I think there is this debate was really an opportunity to think about what it is we're trying to measure and why we're measuring health inequalities, and what kinds of groups it is that we're looking at. So what comes out of the health inequalities debate is this idea that really the kinds of social groups you should be looking at are those social groups that we know to be independently important because they have something to do with the social hierarchy or other aspects of social justice. So naturally you would look at something like social class or ethnic groups. So that's kind of the approach that's taken in the literature, but it seems that approach is somewhat constraining in that the WHO researchers who developed this individual inequalities approach also looked at inequalities within the US, and they had a slightly different way of thinking about social groups, which took into account things like socioeconomic status and race, but also things like geographical location, the urban rural divide, and so on. And they came up with a slightly different way of grouping the US population. And on their account, health inequalities were actually much greater than they were on the sort of conventional approach. And they also argued that the kinds of groups that they came up with were actually also much more similar in terms of the health risks that they were facing. So it seems that from a policy perspective, this, you know, potentially could be quite important information, because you're coming up with groups that are more similar in terms of the kinds of things that would improve their health. So I think, you know, the way the health inequalities literature has gone with this kind of dogmatic insistence on particular kinds of groups that you should be looking at is potentially, means you're missing out on important information. So this is one project I'm hoping to develop. The second project I would like to develop looks at what I call intra-equality conflicts, which is not a pretty word, but it's kind of short. So the idea is that something that's come out in the work that I've done is that, you know, if you're looking at particular issues from the perspective of equality, there's different questions and different concerns that you're going to be interested in, and actually these can come into conflict with one another. So, for example, you know, when you're looking at a particular policy, you might ask questions about how are the benefits and burdens distributed, what does this policy do to inequalities and outcomes or health inequalities. If you're offering a benefit, does everyone have equal access to that benefit? And also with some policies, you might be asking questions about, well, are we treating some people with unequal respect? So these are all requirements of equality, I think. But also there can be trade-offs and conflicts between these different aspects. So one area where I think this really comes out very clearly is in the context of what's called denormalization strategies in tobacco control. So the idea is that, you know, if you have public health campaigns that portray smoking as deviant or disgusting or kind of antisocial and not normal, that gives smokers an incentive to quit. So there's some empirical data to suggest that this is a helpful way of reducing smoking rates. But then, of course, the flip side of this is that you might be treating, you know, you might be stigmatizing smokers as a group, and of course, whenever you're stigmatizing a group of people, you're not treating them with equal respect. You're treating them as somehow inferior because they're engaging in a particular behavior or have a certain characteristic. So, you know, if those denormalization strategies really work, then I think there really is a conflict here between two requirements of equality. On the one hand, you have the sort of distributive concern about outcomes and equality in outcomes, but you have on the other side this, you know, what philosophers sometimes call relational concerns of equality, which are concerns about how we're treating each other. So those kinds of conflicts, I think, haven't really, we don't really have a systematic way of dealing with them, even though certainly from the work that I've done, they kind of keep cropping up if you're looking at different policies. So, you know, having a systematic way of dealing with them, I think, would be very interesting. But I also think it would be philosophically very interesting, because in the philosophical literature, there is this kind of debate between different approaches to equality and, you know, very strong debates about who's got the right view of equality and, you know, who's completely missing the point. Whereas it seems to me that really we would want a full theory of equality that is somehow pluralist in the sense that it can give weight to all these different aspects of equality. So there has been this debate, about different approaches to equality, but little attention among philosophers about what you actually do when, kind of on the ground, these different aspects of equality, can make different recommendations that come into conflict. So this is, I think, there hasn't really been an awful lot of work, and I think this would be very interesting and helpful to do. So I might be running out of time, so I'll just say very quickly, so in terms of approaching this, I think I would like to kind of take a cue from the philosophical debate on conflicts between different kinds of values. So things like conflicts between equality and efficiency, for example, that's probably the most famous conflict. And philosophers find this notoriously difficult to handle because there isn't really, you know, a common currency that holds these, that holds different values together. So it's not really clear how you would evaluate conflicts between them because there's just nothing to compare them, you know, in terms of. So what happens in the certain strategies that have been suggested, and I want to see if they could help us deal with the kinds of conflicts I'm interested in, these conflicts between different aspects of equality. And the first is, you know, to use a deliberative approach. So Norman Daniels is one of the people who recommend this. So when there are conflicts between values, you might say, well, let's just ask, you know, ask people to talk about this, to make arguments for particular positions or particular ways of trading these different values off, and then we can use that to inform policy decisions. I have some concerns about this as a strategy, and I think some of these concerns are going to become particularly salient with the kinds of conflicts that I'm interested in. A second approach, or a second strategy that's sometimes suggested, is a sort of an experimental approach where you kind of sit people down and ask them how they would actually trade off different values, and you kind of, you know, plug that information into your policy decisions, and that gives you a way of, you know, trading off these decisions. So I'd be very interested in kind of testing empirically whether people do have stable preferences about the kinds of conflicts I'm interested in, or whether these are the kinds of preferences where we might be concerned that they are easily manipulated and we're not really getting, you know, any kind of valuable information. And then finally, I want to see if a purely philosophical approach, which doesn't really get off the ground when you're dealing with conflicts between different kinds of values, whether this is something that could work within with the kinds of conflicts I'm interested in, because what holds them together is the fact that they're all different aspects of equality. So is there something in the value of equality that tells us how we can actually deal with these kinds of conflicts? So I, you know, that would be my kind of favourite approach to look at this from a purely philosophical perspective. So I think this would be interesting at a sort of theoretical level, but it's something that, given the pervasiveness of these kinds of conflicts in the real world, I think this would be something that would be very helpful in policy contexts. So having a systematic way of thinking about these conflicts and resolving them or addressing them, I think, would be really helpful from a practical perspective as well.
Good. Okay. Any questions?
Well, I'll ask you to, you mentioned that your dissertation, which I would like to read, I think it really hits on a really interesting issue. I wonder if you could give us just a few highlights. Mm. You know, there's this huge issue of, you know, the standard party line is that it's fine for an employer to incentivize going to a gym, mm-hmm. Right? But it's not fine to, or it may not be fine, or it's less fine to incentivize having a BMI under 27. Mm-hmm. And one of the arguments there is that going to a gym is a voluntary choice, and there's all sorts of things that might preclude people from getting a BMI under 27, mm-hmm. some of which are voluntary, some of which are not. But if you really think deeply about that, there's all sorts of things that are not entirely voluntary about going to a gym. So if I'm a mother of three kids, a mm-hmm. single mom of three kids, and I live very far from a gym, and, you know, all sorts of things. So, yeah. So like, what the metrics by which we define choice and mm-hmm. non-choice related influences on our health, I think, are crucial, and I've not seen a very clear conceptual distinction on sort of how we bucket these things.
Yeah. But I think those issues are tricky, so, you know, I think that's why there isn't really a clear, kind of easy approach to this. So my take on this is to think about this from, you know, from an egalitarian perspective. What matters not so much is thinking about the voluntariness of particular choices, but thinking about how inequalities in background conditions make it easier for some people to meet the requirements to get a certain benefit, but that make it very hard for others to do so. So I think, you know, my take on this is that, I mean, one of the reasons I find incentives very problematic is precisely for that reason. Even when it's, you know, things that are within people's control to do, so to go to the gym, I mean, that's within people's control generally, unless, you know, unless there's really exceptional circumstances. But it is, for some people, it is going to be extremely difficult, and they have to take the cost they would have to accept if they were going to do this in terms of, you know, paying a gym membership. If you're on a very low income, that can make a massive difference. If you have to, you know, work several jobs, you're not going to have the time to actually make use of your membership, and so on. So that's something, you know, I think it doesn't get us very far to think about this in terms of voluntariness, because, you know, you can make a voluntary choice to take all these costs and just go to the gym. But I think from an egalitarian perspective, it would just be unfair to offer a benefit that some people would, you know, some people would find very easy to meet the conditions, whereas other people find it almost impossible. So I think that's my take on this.
So just to go one step further then, so are these inequities in background conditions of, are they inviolable, or are they things that ought to be weighed in concert with, you know, background inequities in health and things that we can do to actually improve people's health and the sort of equally unjust consequences of the healthy subsidizing the unhealthy. So how do we weigh these things? Or is there no weighing involved, and that background inequities, we can't play upon them no matter what?
Well, I mean, so there is this argument that incentives do precisely that. So if, you know, if there's a financial cost to attending a screening appointment, then if you have a financial incentive that can sort of offset some of the costs that people face, and for people for whom financial considerations really come into play, that can address one of the barriers, so you're you know, equalizing some of the inequalities that you're dealing with, where some people, you know, have a lot more money than others and wouldn't find this problematic. So I can sort of see the pull of that argument, but I think that only works if financial considerations, or the kind of, if the incentive actually addresses the barriers fully, and if there aren't any other barriers, which doesn't really seem to be the case in the real world very much, or at least not all of the time. So I'm open to that argument, sort of theoretically, but I don't really see that in practice, you know, this is really, really going to work. Well, there don't seem to be an awful lot of cases where that can be made to work. And your other question was about the sort of unfairness making other people pay for, so as an argument for incentives. Yeah, I find that really problematic.
In what way?
Well, it's sort of,
I mean, it's problematic that the healthy have to pay for the poor. I mean, for the unhealthy. Isn't that problematic?
No, it's not. Is it? Why would you
promote that? Or it's problematic that the young have to pay for the old. The old young end up a huge cash transfer.
No, I mean, I think
that's not unfair.
Sorry, when
either the healthy end up paying for, if you have community rating on insurance, it means that the healthy are drastically subsidizing the unhealthy.
Yeah, that's the idea, isn't it?
Not necessarily.
Well, to my mind, that's the idea.
You might want to limit that, too.
So it's definitely the idea if you're an insurer, but if you're the healthy, that may not be the idea at all.
But isn't that, let me just see if I can follow up on that. Isn't the distinction Zeke just drew not parallel to each other? Because the young, God willing, will actually end up old. But the healthy, if there really are choices that they are making that actually show certain kinds of responsibility, so it collapses back into your concern, they actually may be unfairly having to subsidize folks who are making bad choices. So on the one hand, we're just all going to age, and we're all going to need health care just by the aging process. In the other case of subsidizing, depends on how much personal responsibility you can actually, true personal responsibility, you can actually track down to the healthy. So it seems like the first one.
Well,
really,
but the luck egalitarian wants to get rid of all responsibility in the end. There's not a, I mean, is there anything that is you're actually in the end responsible for? Does it all, I mean, this is, I think, a fundamental, it all ends up dissolving. I've got a high BMI, I've got these physiological things, there's the environment, there's the fact that it's now habitual, it's changed my genes. You know, what am I responsible for? Absolutely nothing.
That's one possible implication of the theory, yeah. So it depends on, it's really just a kind of a framework. So if you, depending on how you want to spell out this idea, this distinction between luck and choice, you could end up with a theory that tells you that nothing is ever anyone's responsibility and all inequalities are unfair.
Where do you come down on that?
Pretty close to that. I think in theory, you know, you can define, you know, the kinds of choices that would lead to inequalities that are fair, but I don't think that those requirements would actually be met in the real world. And certainly when you're thinking about a health context, I mean, lots of health conditions have nothing to do at all with individual choice or individual responsibility. So,
well, wait a second. A ton 60% of ill health is what you eat, nutrition, and smoking.
Yeah.
I just mean, those three things.
Really?
Yes.
60%.
60%.
But here's the thing. Zeke and I might be in a very similar class position, education position, professional position, but he plays
golf. I think
you
make a lot more than I do.
What do I make?
Class? Higher socioeconomic status.
So, shit.
But better social graces.
But here's the thing about Zeke. Nice he actually you. Plays squash. And Autumn doesn't do anything. I'm hoping to start teaching yoga once a week, but he plays squash. But really, what would explain the fact that he plays squash and I don't? He works 2-3 jobs. So is there no room for the fact that I'm culpable for not exercising?
But you're a woman. You'll live longer than I will anyway.
But that's not the point. The point is about personal responsibility. I mean, is there no space here? I used to teach aerobics and 3 times a week. I don't now. But is it really that I'm not choosing in any way that I'm culpable for? When I'm trying to hold class, race, socioeconomic status, education constant, and still see choices.
There is one account of libertarianism that does precisely that. So the idea is that you can group people into sort of groups that are relatively similar with respect to the kinds of criteria that you've just named. And then the idea is that within those groups, any kind of deviations in what people do, that would be due to individual choice. But then again, there might be all sorts of individual factors that you're not really capturing. So,
oh, good. Because I've been feeling really guilty about it.
So, you know, if you want to be really exact, you kind of end up with groups that have one person in them. I find it hard to really scope out some kind of, you know, room for individual choice in this.
What about the flip side?
Oh, yes,
sorry.
Go ahead.
The flip side, which is personal credit or merit? Because every time I reach for my Asian pear instead of my favorite butterscotch, the tasty cake, I feel virtuous because I feel like I am making a choice.
Yeah,
because
you probably shouldn't feel virtuous now.
Really, because some days I actually choose the Asian pear and some days I succumb and choose the butterscotch crimpet. But is it really just because I'm like a puppet on a string? Zeke was mean to me. I took the crimpet.
I think...
or whatever.
Yeah, I think the argument goes
crazy.
So yeah, the argument goes both ways. If you if you don't want to be held responsible, then you also can't claim credit. And that is certainly like egalitarians really sign up to. So it's both benefits and costs of particular choices would not be fair. So, you know, it probably helps to be virtuous when you have fruit instead of chocolate. But
why does it help?
Well, it makes you feel good, right? It's one of the reasons why you might be doing it.
If I'm not responsible, I can't even imagine why it should make me feel good. That's just illusory.
Well,
I'm not responsible. Can't control these things.
But surely
just a roll of the dice.
You don't think you don't do things because they're going to make you feel good?
Maybe, but not that one.
If anything, I'd like to eat the crumpets a lot more. Make me feel a whole lot better.
Especially short term.
I like sugar. I mean, but I don't understand. You know why I should even feel good? That just seems like illusory. Right. If in fact.
Yeah.
It's determined and it's not responsible
I agree,
for.
Yeah. I think, yeah.
Well,
so unless
you should try to
disabuse people of their pat on the back. Pull the wool from their eyes.
Yeah, but I do think that, you know, one possible effect of that might be that they would just do the unhealthy thing because
right.
I do.
We know that stigma works. Making people feel guilty works.
So yeah.
Presumably it works because they do think that they're responsible for it, among other things.
Yeah, so it might, you know, the illusion, as you said, of individuals...
Well, now you're sounding like a horrible Benthamite utilitarian about keeping people, you know, stupid and about the real workings of the world. And
no, but I think, I mean, philosophers make a lot of... I think, you know, philosophers really struggle with this to kind of... At this, you know, on the one hand, we feel responsible for the things that we do and we feel responsible for the beliefs that we have and the preferences that we have. But at the same time, we can, you know, you can sometimes even say why you have certain preferences, why you have certain beliefs. Those are kind of things that both of the, you know, those are not really illusions in that sense, but, you know, we are aware of the fact that all sorts of circumstances influence the way we you know, what we believe and the kinds of preferences that we have, and at the same time we still feel responsible. So, you know, I mean, this is something we kind of deal with. I think everyone, certainly philosophers, try to find a way to make these two aspects consistent.
Can I ask a follow-up to that? So the relational concerns mm-hmm. about stigma and things like mm-hmm. this are problematic. Mm-hmm. In Canada, you have these really fancy and graphic cigarette cartons, right? With pictures of people that are...
Oh, yeah. Well, they have them here, too. Don't they have them here, too?
Not
they
yet.
Have,
no, they
them, they?
No.
Oh,
no.
They're certainly in magazines now, with the guy in the wheelchair emaciated from lung cancer.
I mean, let's... Shaming people works sometimes to mm-hmm. move people from to smoking cessation, right? So,
yeah.
Is it intrinsically wrong to show these horrible, you know, graphic images that maybe shape people's ideas about what smokers are like, and if in fact the empirical evidence shows that it actually works to prevent smoking?
So, I don't think the graphic warning labels are meant to shame necessarily. I mean, they are meant to scare.
You don't think they're meant to stigmatize?
I don't think so.
And even if they're not meant to, and so they do stigmatize.
I think, yeah. I think that's
yeah. But, I mean, there are some campaigns.
I think they are.
So, for example, in the UK, they ran this ad where there's a woman in a bar, and this sort of this guy across, you know, the other end of the room sort of looking at her, and then he finally comes over and to talk to her, and he kind of bends down to talk to her, and you see kind of his face changes. He looks really disgusted, and he has, you know, a pint of beer in his hand, which is almost full, and he points at it and kind of leaves. And then there's this tagline, "If you smoke, you stink." So that's a kind of, you know, that's a sort of denormalization campaign where there's this idea that you're kind of, you know, smoking mm-hmm. is nasty, it's disgusting. And there are other campaigns, you know, where there's a clearer sense that you're really trying to shame people. So that's, I think, it is intrinsically problematic to shame and to stigmatize, I think, because you are treating people as unequal, and you know, you're kind of creating this idea that, you know, people just smoke out of choice. There is no kind of sense for how addictiveness of nicotine might play a role in this, or susceptibility to advertising, which is, you know, very, you know, high-powered advertising.
Sure, sure, sure.
Often targeted advertising that goes specifically into low-income neighbourhoods. So I find that intrinsically problematic. But it doesn't follow from that we should never be doing it. I think if it turned out that, you know, you could do this and really
right.
people would kind of quit smoking in huge numbers, then I would probably say, you know, if there's nothing else that works to that extent, which you know, may very well be true, then you probably go for it.
Grounding here.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's definitely a cost.
Now, is that somehow, are these ads somehow different than targeting someone with a tax?
I think it is very different. I mean, taxes aren't primarily meant to change social norms, although they might have that implication as well, but I think the primary way that they're meant to work is to just make it more expensive to engage in a certain behaviour. Although, yeah, you're right.
You know,
they do also
tax,
signal.
You know, getting married is a nice, you know, tax break, or having a kid. You know, there's certain things that are incentivized through taxes that
there was a marriage penalty.
Marriage penalty, yeah. One
disincentive.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Filing jointly was actually better for us last year for some reason, but so I think taxes speak to huge social values and.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of policies, I guess, that have this kind of symbolic. You know, there's a sort
it's more than symbolic.
Expressive.
It has an incentive structure. I mean, if you believe the economists, it definitely is meant to bias you one way or another, and not
mm-hmm.
just. I mean,
yeah, that's what I said. So that's
change behavior, but also change attitudes about the right behaviors.
Mm. But it doesn't signal, you know, when you have a break on, you know, if you your taxes improve because you're married, that doesn't really signal that unmarried people are abnormal. I mean,
okay. And
you know,
surely taxing cigarettes never really kind of stigmatized smoking, right?
No, that definitely worked.
Absolutely. Oh, it made it more expensive, but it didn't.
So do you think I have a question. Do you think there's a difference between stigmatizing smoking, smokers stink, and fat people are bad?
I
or are those just the same?
they're very similar. I mean, with, I think with obesity, the climate seems even worse to me because we know, although I don't know, is it worse? I was going to say it's worse because we don't really know how to help people to lose weight, but we don't really know how to help people quit smoking.
No, in both cases we have poorly but effective methods. They work in the 5-10% range of getting people to either quit smoking or lose weight. We actually know how to do those things. They're not very successful, but they are. They're not zero.
Yeah, I would say that means we don't know how to do it in a. You know,
it's
say
just
5
really
to
10%. Hard. No, I think it's different. I think it's really hard. Doesn't mean you don't know what to do. And does the fact that one is addictive and one is not addictive, one is voluntary and some taking it up is voluntary, the other you have to eat, make a difference?
I guess it makes a difference. It could make a difference to some extent, but there's a lot of, you know, these things have a lot in common. There's sort of the social factors that contribute to both, both food and smoking, and all the context of the kind of have a social function. So, you know, people share cigarettes, and obviously food has, you know, it's just culture and has a social function. So there are a lot of similarities, and I think I don't see that one would be any better than the other, I have to say.
Okay. Can I ask a question? Oh, you first. Yeah.
So is there a general critique here about the ethics of propaganda? And when you were talking, it made me think that there was, to the extent that people can manipulate others' decisions by information or by incentives, doesn't that give you one measure of choice or the extent of choice?
So what do you mean?
So in other words, if you can actually change people's preferences by information, changing information content or the way you present information, then that gives you a kind of indirect way of saying that to the extent that you can manipulate them, that their decisions were, that they are exercising choice. Mm. So it's just, you see what I mean? I don't know what work it'll do for you. But it's
so I think with these public health campaigns, I'm not sure I would call that manipulation, because the mechanism isn't primarily, I think, I mean, I'm not
really
sure
what
the mechanism is going to be, but it would be something through social norms. So if you change social norms, that's going to change what people would want to do.
You aren't changing them by presenting information in a particular way.
I guess,
so it's,
yeah, but it's not manipulation in the sort of subliminal advertising sort of way, or putting food on a different shelf, or... it's not a very subtle mechanism. It's not a very subtle
propaganda. Or the your brain on drugs advertising in the '80s. I mean, it was in the U.S. It was Reagan era. Yeah, but it was, you know, showed an egg.
Yeah.
Oh,
and then
yeah,
your egg on drugs in a frying pan.
Yeah.
But it's clearly propaganda. And it's not subtle at all.
Yeah. But I guess there are more subtle ways of, you know, some of these ideas around the nudge proposals. Mm-hmm. Those are much more subtle. Mm-hmm. And potentially much more manipulative, because you don't even know when it's happening to you. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that to me seems to undermine the idea that people are making a choice, because if it's, you know, that easily manipulated, that suggests that, you know, this wasn't really a kind of deliberative choice. Because if it were a deliberative choice, then they shouldn't be so easy to change, to manipulate.
But is it deliberative? Is that deliberative a necessary component in choice, in exercising choice?
I thought that was the question you were asking. So if it's, I mean, it's sort of choice in a sort of philosophically kind of relevant sense, the kind of choice that we would think would justify inequalities, and then you would kind of think those should be choices that are reasonably deliberative. So, you know, if you can kind of sway those choices with, you know, very little, and people may not even notice, that to me, I wouldn't consider a kind of choice in that sort of sense. Yeah. I don't know if that answers the question.
I was wondering if there's any way of hierarchizing or rating the various modes or levels of stigmatizing and approaches to stigmatizing that some of these campaigns do. And I'll give you an example. Your smoker stink campaign is one level that addresses the smoker, him or herself. But the secondhand smoke campaign I find to be maybe even more worrisome, because it has more responsibility. And I'll give you an example of how far this has permeated. My daughter, I was at a funeral yesterday for my daughter, daughter's best friend's father who died of lung cancer, but he was not a smoker. The whole family, including the 10-year-old, and my daughter including, have now accused the family of origin of killing the dad, so the brothers, sisters, and parents, from the secondhand smoke campaign, that they have now decided, with no, of course, empirical evidence, that the reason he died was because he was raised in a home with smokers. And that's, the secondhand smoke campaign is all over. And I had to go a great distance yesterday to explain to my 10-year-old that smoking is very addictive. Of course, you should never start. But once people start, it's not part of the dialogue. So it's just these people are homicidal, basically. And it's absolutely tragic. I mean, there's an entire side of the family that this little 10-year-old will not speak to because they killed her dad, and I see it. It's all over now. The secondhand smoke campaign has achieved great milestones with the end of smoking bars and every other place. But now it's a whole other level, it seems to me, of moral culpability.
Yeah.
Not only do you don't kill yourself, that's lung cancer.
That's right.
Now you've killed other people, and it's Christopher Reeve's wife. She supposedly she died because she worked in a bar. I mean, this is out there now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is really problematic. And in fact, I remember reading a study of people with lung cancer who found that, you know, even as non-smokers, they felt really stigmatized because there is this link. But you know, this idea that lung cancer is always kind of your own fault because you smoked, even though there is a, you know, small-ish proportion of smokers.
17% or
so. Yeah. So, actually, that's a good
But the blame ethos is out there in lung cancer, so if you can't blame yourself, you're looking for the, you know.
Yeah, and there was an Australian commercial, sort of a campaign. I think this was stopped before it really went very far, but it was kind of, you sort of see this small child sitting at a table, and what seems to be the mother is sitting next to it and sort of preparing kind of an injection of heroin. And sort of getting the child ready to inject this. And then just before she's kind of about to kind of put the needle in, you see the child picking up a hamburger. And then the tagline is, you wouldn't inject your child with junk, so why feed it to them?
Wow.
And then it says, break the habit, child's obesity. So this is, I think, kind of pretty much what you're talking about.
That's pretty.
Yeah.
No holds barred.
So, yeah, I think this is really hugely problematic, the kind of moralized discourse around health behaviors and this idea that, you know, especially when parents are involved, harming their children, this sort of idea that this is kind of parents choosing to expose their children to some sort of fatal risk. And yeah, and to kind of call it break the habit, I think it's just sort of even worse because it's sort of implying that there is, you know, some completely isolated behavior that has nothing to do with how we structure food environments and appetite. I think it's just, it's horrendous. So yeah. But I actually thought about, you know, this in relation to the, you know, the other ad, where the smoking ad, we kind of portray smoking as disgusting and nasty. And initially I thought, you know, I would rather be told that something I do is disgusting than to be told that it's kind of immoral. But actually one thing about the kind of moralized argument is that you can, you know, you can make a case against it. So you can argue, you know, with the kinds of implicit assumptions that you see in those kinds of ads, and you know, you can explain to your child why smoking is different and why this kind of moralized, you know, this idea of the homicidal smoker, why this doesn't really, you know, isn't really accurate. You can kind of make an argument there. Whereas if the argument is just, well, smoking stinks and it's unattractive and it means that, you know, men won't want to talk to you in bars, what do you say to that?
Yes, they will. I mean, you're right. You don't fight that.
So let's give you 5 minutes to ask us questions. You will get, obviously, chances to talk to many of us individually.
You've already told me a little bit about where you see the department heading, but, you know, it'd be really nice to hear a bit more about kind of what your plans are, and in particular where you see the philosophers, you know, the philosophers that would be hired for this position, where you see them fitting in and what kind of work you would like to see them do.
Well, I think I've always had a view that the bioethics world needs a rigor upgrade. We need a lot more rigor, and so getting philosophers into the field is one way of doing that. Mm-hmm. But I also think similarly that philosophers need to appreciate the ethical issues that arise in bioethics. For some reason, philosophers are obsessed by things like abortion and free speech, which I think are relevant, but they're relatively minor issues, whereas a lot of the stuff in healthcare are, you know, much more everyday issues, which, and I think have interesting ethical insights into lots of our more general theories, which philosophers haven't done. So, you know, part of my campaign, both at the NIH and here, is to sort of get more mainstream philosophers involved in some of these issues. I think, you know, there's nothing more complex but more important than the priority setting in healthcare, both for what it says about priority setting generally, but healthcare is at 18-20% of GDP is certainly consuming a lot, and figuring out what to do about that is, I think, exceedingly important. So that's one aspect, sort of more general. Locally on the campus, would be, you know, we're hoping that the philosophers will bring us and the philosophy department together. The philosophy department's going to undergo some important changes over the next few years. They have a lot of spare faculty space, so they're going to be hiring, and I think having some impact on that, more into the ethics, both theoretical and applied, would probably be a good thing for this philosophy department.
And one thing I was wondering is, it seems that the teaching component is actually quite small, even though there is a master's program.
Right.
So the position.
The position will have one course a year. That's what we're going to expect of. Mm-hmm. Not every faculty will teach that. Some of us will teach too. But that's a sort of, for these positions. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might evolve over time, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of it, the goal is to have sort of 60 plus percent, 60 to 70% protected research time.
And is there, so is it going to be very important to bring in grant money, or is that less important?
We would like people to support themselves over time. We, you know, there may be cases in which people will apply for career development awards, or to work on grants with other people where other people are sort of the primary, but they're providing a necessary service.
And what's the relationship between the department and the Center for Bioethics?
The center does not exist, or will not exist, whenever someone signs off on the papers.
Okay.
Yeah, it in the current arrangement, it makes no sense. There's really complete overlap, and, you know, at one time, given the way the university structures itself, it made sense. It doesn't make any more sense.
Okay.
No one can quite. Penn has this tendency. We have more than 150 departments at Penn. The centers at Penn, and no one has, we know how to create them, no one has a good sense of how to actually terminate them and sunshine them. So, yeah, it's been now at the dean's office for over a month, and they don't seem to know what paper does someone sign, who signs it. What?
Never done it before.
Huh? Yes, exactly. It appears that no one really knows. So, in any case, everyone's agreed that when someone figures out what the actual operations are, you press the button, we'll press the button. But from an operate, from a practical standpoint, it really is functionally the department.
Okay, but you're going to continue with the master's program, and
and as I mentioned to you, we're going to add another master's program for particularly people who are going to work in the field, become.
That sounds great.
All right. Well, you'll be able to talk and ask more questions to others.
So I think you're free for a bit.